The Great American Road Trip. The 1970s cooked up the perfect recipe for family road trips. That's the conclusion of author Richard Rattay, and he ought to know. His new book, Don't Make Me Pull Over, The Informal History of the American Road Trip, is part memoir, part history lesson. He shows us how a combination of a new federal highway system, cars that might be better described as land yachts, a middle class with discretionary income, the advent of motels and gas stations, and restaurants shaped like UFOs and sombreros, all combined to create a nation that loved to hit the road. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Rattay joins us today to share his insights and discoveries about the golden era of the family road trip. And we invite you to share your stories. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Summertime and the living is easy. Unless it's circa 1977 and you and your siblings are crammed into the back of a station wagon, headed on a long car ride to some far-off vacation destination. The family road trip, that's our topic today. It is the subject of a new book by Richard Rattay, part memoir, part pop history, and part nostalgic look back at a time before car rides included iPods and DVD players and GPS. The title of the book is Don't Make Me Pull Over, and Richard Rattay joins us from the Milwaukee public radio station WUWM. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me on.
As always, we want to hear from you in the audience. Share some of your favorite road trip memories. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Richard, what a fun book. And I have to say, it triggered a lot of memories for me and the rest of the Maine Calling team as we discussed it this morning. So I'm sure it's going to be the same thing for our audience today. But how on earth did you get the idea to write a history of the family road trip?
Yes. Well, shockingly enough, the idea for a book about family vacations actually came to me while on a family vacation. I was on a road trip, and I think my boys were screwing around in the back seat. They're 6 and 8 years old at the time. And I got back to thinking about what life was like for me when I was their age and traveling the highways of the 1970s with my siblings and my parents. I was the youngest of four kids. And I just thought those family road trips gave me some of my fondest childhood memories. They really broadened my horizons at that age in so many ways, getting to see all these different areas of the country, try different foods, hear the different ways that people spoke in different areas of the country. And really, I think those long hours together brought me closer to my brothers and sister and my parents for really a lifetime. But it also occurred to me how little I knew about how that great American road trip experience came to be. I didn't know how we got things like, you know, our interstate highways or fuzzbusters or 8-track tape decks, all those great devices we had in our cars, or even why our family station wagon had fake wood paneling on the sides. I just had no idea about these things. So when I got home from that family vacation, I hit the local library. I read book after book. I did more research online. I spent about a year researching before I ever started writing anything. And I just I knew I had the stories and historical nuggets that would make for a great book. So I sat down and wrote it.
So you've actually brought up one of the questions our producer Cindy Hahn wants to know, which is, where did the wood paneling on station wagons come from?
Yeah, well, it's actually hinted at in its name, station wagon, and where those vehicles came from. Around the 1900, right at the turn of the century there, the dominant form of long-distance transportation was still trains. But what was needed was a vehicle to transport train passengers from their homes to train stations. And that's kind of the void that station wagons filled in. So at that time, it was, of course, just, you know, the early car manufacturers. They'd build these cars really just for passengers and not for carrying, you know, big trunks or lots of luggage. So handymen would take like a Model T, they'd hack off the metal body at the windshield, and they would recreate that entire car body in wood so that it could accommodate passengers up front and big trunks and lots of luggage in the back. And that was really the genesis of the station wagon. And so whenever we see, you know, like wood paneling on the sides of those station wagons, it's kind of an homage to the origins of the original station wagons.
Oh, that's great. So your thesis overall, if thesis is an appropriate word for your for your book.
We'll use that term loosely.
Is that the 1970s percolated the perfect combination of factors to make this a road trip crazed nation? Not just the infrastructure to do it, but also the right vibe, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, you know, during the 1970s, by that time, the interstate highways, they were actually still being built, but many of them had been around long enough that, you know, there'd been time for restaurants and all the great, you know, restaurant chains and hotel chains to kind of develop alongside the interstate highways. We had all those great devices that I was talking about earlier in our cars, things like 8-track tape decks, fuzz busters to help us elude, you know, the police. And we just had some great automobiles out there too, right? We had those classic Ford Country Squire station wagons and things like the VW Thing. Do you remember that?
I do.
Or the Saab Brat, you know, or the El Camino. There were just so many great vehicles out on the highways. And it was such an odd combination, too, because, you know, of course, during the 1970s, we had all those land yachts, the real full-size automobiles. But you also, because of the fuel crunch in the early 1970s, you started seeing some of these tiny imports. And, of course, you had the custom vans. And so it was just a place of all these wild and interesting vehicles out on the highways at the same time. And of course, we also didn't have things like seatbelt laws. So, you know, as a kid, I was free to, you know, climb up on the rear window shelf and basically make that my private perch throughout our trips. So it was just, you know, it was a different era. You know, maybe not the safest of eras, but it sure was a fun time.
So there are a lot of characters who find their way into your book. These are not household names, but I get the sense that you think they ought to be. For example, the man who took the first cross-country road trip.
Yeah.
We've heard of Charles Lindbergh, but we haven't heard of him. Tell me about him and tell me about that journey.
Yeah, and we all should have heard about Horatio Jackson, because this is just an amazing story and just one of my favorites in the history of great American road travel. So the year is 1903. Horatio Jackson was a young surgeon from Vermont. He's out vacationing in San Francisco with his new wife. And like many bad ideas, this idea is generated after a few cocktails and as the result of a bet made in essentially a bar. Jackson went out drinking with a friend one night and soon finds himself embroiled in debate with another patron about whether cars, which are new vehicles at these times, are the future of transportation or just a passing fad. And even though Jackson had never owned an automobile, had barely ever driven one, and despite the fact that there aren't basically any roads built west of the Mississippi River, he declares that automobiles are already so rough and rugged that he could drive one clear across the country back to his home in Vermont. Well, you know, a little surprise here. His assertion is challenged. A bet amount is set, $50, which, you know, about $1,200 in today's money. It wasn't a great deal of money to Jackson. He was a pretty wealthy man. But all of a sudden, he finds himself having to live up to his end of the bet. So, of course, the most difficult thing I think he had to do was go home and explain his bet to his new wife. She was a smart woman. She immediately booked a train trip for herself back to home to Vermont. And Jackson finds himself a great mechanic by the name of Sewell Crocker. On Crocker's recommendation, he buys a 20-horsepower Winton touring car. The two of them loaded up with all sorts of camping equipment and cooking equipment, everything you'd need for basically an expedition across, you know, the great wilderness of America, which it basically still is at this time. Those two set off. They start traveling north. They're trying to avoid the Rocky Mountains, which had doomed earlier efforts to cross the country by car. Of course, 15 miles into their journey, they pop their first tire, requiring them to use their only spare. A little bit while later, they pop two more tires. They have to wind the rims of the wheels in heavy rope just so that they can continue making progress to their next town, where hopefully they can get some more spares. They stop to ask a woman directions at one point. She sends them 100 miles out of their way just so that some of her extended family members can get their first look at an automobile. So, if you thought your road trips were bad, just imagine what these guys were going through. And this is before they even really got off the West Coast. But somewhere along the line, Jackson spots a stray pit bull. They pick him up and make him their third travel companion. They name him Bud, and Bud seems to change their luck. Things start going better for him, although they notice that Bud's eyes start welling up with tears because of the dust getting kicked up by the tires of the car. So they have Bud outfitted for his own little pair of goggles. Well, the press catches wind of this, and photographers start turning out to meet the trio at every town they visit, and they become national celebrities. They finally get across the Mississippi River, where there actually are some roads built at that time. The going gets easier. And 63 days later, Bud, Sewell Crocker, and Horatio Jackson roll into Times Square, becoming the first to have completed a transcontinental crossing of America by car.
In 1903, how much has changed? Were they, before they hit the Mississippi River, were they just going on cart paths and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, they're following really the route of the Oregon Trail. So it's, you know, it's some dirt paths, but they're not really made for cars. So, you know, it was rough going, and especially, of course, having to cross mountains. They're still having to cross some mountains in the West. And one of the toughest areas was the arid salt flats around Salt Lake City as well. That was really rough going. So, yeah, at one point, even earlier in their trip, they lost their cooking equipment and didn't even notice it because of, you know, the noise that the car is making. And they have to stop and basically beg for food at points along the way just so that they can keep going. So, yeah, it was quite an adventure.
So that's Horatio Jackson. Tell us about Carl Fisher.
Oh, Carl Fisher was from Indianapolis. He was one of the great promoters, a self-made millionaire. He originally was a big bike advocate, but then when automobiles started coming along, he became, I believe, the first car dealer in the Midwest. In order to promote the sale of vehicles and of Presto Light headlamps, he was also the head of this big Presto Light headlamp company, the first gas compressed headlamps. He had this dream of building the first transcontinental highway across America, and he wanted to build it all with private funds. So at this time, he's a pretty influential guy. He knows Woodrow Wilson and Thomas Edison and some of the great executives of the auto industry at that time. He calls them all together for a big dinner party, lays out his plan to build this great highway across America. They get somewhat on board. They start writing checks, but it's not nearly enough, of course, to cover the cost of a semi-paved route across America, and he wants it built. This is in 1913. He's hoping to get this highway across America built in time for the 1915 World's Fair. Well,
he was ambitious.
He was quite ambitious, yes. But they do start building it. Of course, it takes until about 1930 for them to complete this highway, and at a cost of about 30 times original projections, and even then, there's spots of this highway that are basically impassable. But needless to say, it provided the stories for many great adventures of people trying to cross this highway while it was still being worked on, including the 1919 motor transport convoy by the Army, which was a 100 vehicle expedition, of which Dwight D. Eisenhower was actually a young lieutenant who traveled along on that journey. And of course, that would come into play when Eisenhower would later become president and would become the big champion for building America's interstate highways.
And that was interesting, too, because there was a lot of controversy at the time about who was going to pay for the highways. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the great axioms of road building, I guess. Everybody loves having great roads, and no one wants to pay for them. Originally, Eisenhower, when he came up with his grand plan for interstates, was hoping to have contributions from all of the states. But of course, the governors balked at that idea. Eventually, Eisenhower relented and conceded that because the highways were predominantly for federal interests, of course, he wanted the highways as a defense measure to enable the army to move around the country more easily, and also to allow urban dwellers to get out of cities in the event of an atomic attack. Finally, Eisenhower conceded that the federal government would pay for the vast majority of the costs. A gas tax was levied to help out with things. And that's how the interstate highways were funded in 1956.
Well, it seems to me the biggest character of them all in your book, and this is pretty high praise, is your dad.
Yeah.
It seems like he had a strategy about your road trips. They started, at 3 in the morning, right, to beat traffic.
Yeah.
And he didn't stop for anything. But I want you to read a section of the book, which I think just says so much about your dad. You have just taught us about the genesis of the Fuzzbuster, the first radar detector. And you talk about how a lot of people had them, but not you.
Yeah. So I guess I'll just get into the passage here. I never quite understood my dad's reluctance to buy one. The cost wasn't prohibitive, even for a man as frugal as my father. A low-end Fuzzbuster retailed for less than the cost of 2 speeding tickets. We'd certainly get plenty of use out of the device between the considerable amount of travel we did as a family and the many miles my father logged for work. But I'm not sure Dad could get past the stigma that came with it. In a way, plopping a Fuzzbuster up on your dash was like extending a big electronic middle finger to the police. It smacked of the post-hippie authoritative sentiment, anti-authority sentiment raging at the time, and my father wanted no part of it. After all, he was a dyed-in-the-wool Republican, a family man, an upstanding member of society. He didn't want to join the ranks of the long hairs and scofflaws, the wearers of fringed leather jackets. When it came to the ridiculous 55-mile-an-hour speed limit, he didn't mind breaking the law. He just didn't want others to know he was doing it. Other drivers had no such reservations. Fuzzbuster sales soared, spawning a $400 million industry by the 1980s. In 2010, Dale Smith's original Fuzzbuster was named one of Time magazine's all-time 100 gadgets.
Oh my! I love that because it tells so much about that time, but it also has got a lot of people out there nodding and agreeing.
Yeah.
And they all either had a dad like that or a dad who said, oh, what the heck, I'm going to buy myself a Fuzzbuster.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because I found that dads kind of fall into 2 categories, too, when I was doing the research for the book and telling people about what I was writing about. I think the vast majority of dads were like mine, who were all about what he called making time. He just wanted to get to that day's destination as fast as possible, whether it was our hotel room for the evening or our final destination or wherever. But he just wanted to get to that destination as fast as possible. And if that meant, you know, skipping meals or ignoring our pleas to pull over so that we could use the restroom, he was okay with that. And then there were the other set of dads who wanted to stop at every historic landmark along the way and every roadside attraction and alligator farm, whatever. They wanted to do it all along the way. But my dad was not one of those. He just wanted us to get where we were going.
Well, Rich, I see that your publisher had you put together a playlist of tunes that have meant something to you on road trips. And we're going to play a few of those during today's program. As we go to our first break, we are going to play a song that I think probably everyone knows, Convoy. Why is this significant to you?
Yeah, obviously, Convoy was a big part of that great CB craze during the 1970s that had us all saying silly things like 10-4, good buddy, and keep on trucking and talking about Kojaks with Kodaks. The song was actually by C.W. McCall. That was a nom de plume, if you will, for an advertising executive whose real name was William Freeze. He wrote the song originally for a campaign to advertise bread. It became so popular, he turned it into an actual song. It was released and went to number one in, I think, like 30 countries around the world and became part of this great CB craze. They even made a movie out of the song.
Oh, my goodness. Here we go.
By the time we got into Tulsa town, we had 85 trucks and all. But there's a room block up on the clover leaf, and them bears are wall to wall. And them smokies as thick as bugs on a bumper. They even had a bear in the air. I says, calling all trucks, this here's the duck. We about to go a-hunting there. 'Cause we got a great big convoy rocking through the night. Yeah, we got a great big convoy. Ain't she a beautiful sight? Come on and join.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Northeast Imports in South Portland, specializing in the sale and service of pre-owned Subarus, northeastimportsllc.com.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we'll hear from Edwin Raymond, one of 12 police officers who's charged that the NYPD continues to use illegal quotas.
Quotas are still a very real way of how the department operates. Like, those numbers are still what's incentivized. People respond to incentives. That officer that wants to make detective doesn't have to be a genius to realize what's going to be respected.
That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock and Sunday night at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. There is a good chance the online Maine Public Community Calendar lists something you might be interested in doing, or maybe several. You'll find it online at mainepublic.org. And if you represent an organization, you can list your event there for free as well. Concerts, exhibits, hikes, dinners, lectures, outings, events of all stripes and colors, and all searchable by date, location, or type of event. Visit mainepublic.org and click on Events and then the Community Calendar.
Happy people pass my way. Looking in their eyes, I see a memory.
Let's face it, you're smiling right now. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the family road trip. On the line with us, Richard Rette. He is the author of a book entitled Don't Make Me Pull Over, a fun look back at the family road trip. The book is called Don't Make Me Pull Over. Rich was the last of four kids raised by two mostly attentive parents in Wisconsin. He has been an award-winning advertising copywriter for 25 years. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Rich, you don't make your children listen to Barry Manilow, do you?
No, I do not. But I do make them listen to some of my music in the car. I'm infamous for putting together playlists that are kind of, you know, appropriate for the destinations that we're going to be heading to, or for some of the sites or roadside attractions that we see along the way. So, yeah, I kind of give my kids a little bit of history, whether they like it or not, along the way.
Why did we play Mandy? Why do you like that song so much?
Well, in 1974, my dad, for one of the few times in his life, as you might have picked up on, my dad was quite a cost-conscious fellow, so he wasn't normally one to buy a new car. But he did in 1974 because his eye was caught by this new Oldsmobile Toronado that came out. And as an enticement to get him to buy that car, the salesman threw in 2 8-tracks for the 8-track tape deck that we had in our car. It was the first one that we ever had. And so it was such a novelty for us to be able to play any song that we wanted to, you know, anywhere out in the country during our road trips. And one of those 8-tracks was Barry Manilow's, Barry Manilow 2 or whatever album that Mandy was on. And we played that song to death, much to the my older brother sure didn't like it. Let's just say that.
But you survived. Oh,
yes.
My.
It almost initiated a civil war in our car, but we did make it back, yes.
On the line with us now, Brian Kevin, who's managing editor of Down East Magazine. And this month's cover article, coincidentally, is a Route 1 road trip. Hi, Brian. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
What inspired this month's edition of Down East?
Well, Route 1 inspired it. 527 miles of the finest driving in Maine It's something that the magazine has done in the past. I think the last time we did a Route 1 themed issue was maybe 7 or so years ago. I did it once before in the 90s. And it's just always a hit with people because for so many, this is like an introduction to the state. It's a way to get a really great overview of the breadth of the state if you happen to be inclined to drive it from Kittery to Fort Kent. And for a lot of us who live here, it's like a fairly pedestrian commute.
Right, and Fort Kent is mile one, right? Well, depending which way you count.
Depending which way you're headed, yeah.
Do you have a favorite main road trip?
I'm pretty fond of driving Route 11, like way up through the Northwoods and into the county. I don't know if you've ever done that, but you get some really pretty terrific views of Katahdin along the way and cool little towns. It's a route that I've driven quite a bit solo to do various reporting things up in the northern corners of the state, but have done it with my family a time or two as well. And you can sort of stay at a cool little sporting lodge along the way, and there's all kinds of, you know, neat roadside attractions.
All right. Well, Brian, well, we have you on the phone, and since you mentioned your family, have any stories to share before we let you go?
Like Richard Rutte, I grew up in Wisconsin, so go Pack Go, Richard.
Nice.
And, you know, my family used to drive up to the Northwoods, which, doing that in Wisconsin is not so different from how folks do it in Maine, head up north to the camp. We would say the cabin back home, or we would drive up to a town called Minocqua. My family had, when I was a kid, a Chevy Caprice wagon, which was the flower car belonging to a funeral home before we had it. We called it the hearse. It was not technically a hearse, but it was quite recognizable as a car that once belonged to a funeral home. Big black monster of a thing. And we would sit in there and drive up north, and my sister and I would sit in the way back. I don't know. This has got to take up some real estate in your book, Richard, but the fight over where to sit on these road trips seems pretty classic.
And, absolutely. Did you have one of those rear-facing seats in the back that popped up out of the...
That is the way back, is it not, sir?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, sometimes we just set up little forts, you know, back near the window and didn't even pop the seats up so that we could spread out and take a nap back there, right?
Yeah, it's like you know where you're going. You want to see where you've been. And we would have sing-alongs. That's what I remember more than anything else, was like singing along to my dad's atrocious soundtrack of like bad 70s and 80s arena rock.
Sure.
Journey and Kansas and God, those songs will never leave my mind.
Bad? You mean good, right?
Yeah, well, right. Sometimes one is indistinguishable from the other, I guess, and the road trip would be one of those times.
Now, did you play any games as well? Did you play, like, the license plate game or, you know, license
plate
bingo,
you know,
the alphabet game?
I have kids now who are just old enough that we've started to try and play these games. Ours was, and it was like my father owned a grocery store. These days we throw in mother because why shouldn't a mother own a grocery store? But as a kid we played my father owned a grocery store. And
oh, yeah.
With a letter, and then the kids in the back seat would have to guess the item for sale in the grocery store. Why groceries and not other forms of retail? I don't know. But that was definitely a very common way to pass the time.
Nice. One of my family's favorites was to play Mad Libs. Do you remember what Mad Libs were? Or are? I guess they're still around.
4-year-old. Just about every night before bed. He's a big
kid. Oh, they're fantastic, and it's something that allows the whole family to participate. They're short stories with words left out, and in order to fill in those blanks, you ask for blind suggestions from people around the car. And this was a game that even my older teenage brothers didn't mind playing because you'd add in all these out-of-context suggestions into the story and read that story back at the end, and it would just be hilarious. There were times, you know, when we were on the road for 10, 12 hours at a time, and we're kind of loopy, and we would read some of these stories back, and we are just crying because we are laughing so hard.
Well, Brian, go ahead.
With podcasts, and as much as I love listening to podcasts, and that can be a great way to kill time, yeah, I miss some of these things. So this is a really fun show to listen to.
Brian, thank you. And Down East Magazine's Route 1 Road Trip is out this month. Thanks for calling in. And speaking of Route 1, we're going to read a post, from Amy on Facebook. She writes, "My parents were both displaced Mainers who raised their family in Connecticut in the 1940s and 50s. On every road trip back to Maine, as the old Sarah Mildred Long Bridge over the Piscataqua River came into view, one would quote from the legend of Sleepy Hollow, quote, once you cross that bridge, my friend, the ghost is through. His power ends. Sadly, my father died when my four siblings were young, and before I was born, but my mother continued the tradition with all of us kids joining in to shout the last words. And I still say them today when I return to Maine after a trip anyway. Well, thanks for sharing that. We'll move to Tom, who's calling from Booth Bay Harbor. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Howdy. I've done a few road trips in my life, but it was always the bucket list one of driving a Model T from coast to coast. And I did that a year ago last May and wrote a book about it. We'd started in New York City at the eastern terminus of the Lincoln Highway, 42nd Street and Broadway, and drove it to the base of the Golden Gate Bridge, 3,707 miles. And it was just magical. About a 100-year-old car on about a 100-year-old road.
Wow. Well, that sounds like a fantastic experience. So what were some of the highlights?
You know, I have to tell you that to me, it was the smells. It was the smells that inside sedans we don't appreciate. But when you're driving through farm country, you can smell farmers cutting hay or the fertilizer going down. Or you can smell the first drops of raindrops falling on a farm field or somebody cutting their lawn. And you know, we were going to do it offline. We were going to be completely unplugged, but we decided that it was too much fun to interact with people on Facebook, and people offered us places to stay, you know, in 100-year-old homes, and we ate in old restaurants. So we really tried to, except for Facebook, we tried to live a 100-year-old adventure.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. And you know, I mean, as you kind of point out, I mean, a road trip like that is really how you can experience real America. And you can only get those experiences by driving through America instead of flying over it. And, you know, especially on local highways like the Lincoln Highway was, where, you know, you actually got to experience the local culture, kind of savor the local flavor, see what products are made in those communities and what they value most and what, you know, historical events might have taken place in those towns and communities along the way. And even when we went to the interstate highways, you know, that kind of isolated motorists from the surrounding landscape a little bit and really changed the experience. So even though it allowed Americans to visit areas of the country that they wouldn't normally have been able to get to because it made that trip so much faster, it also isolated us from, you know, some of those experiences of being able to go through local towns and communities like you did.
Well, Tom, thanks
Indeed.
For calling in. What a great experience. That was Tom in Booth Bay Harbor. We're going to move on to Jenny calling from Winthrop. Hi, Jenny. Go ahead.
Hi. I grew up in the 60s, and my family, we had a country squire, Ford country squire, and we put down the back seats. There were and then we'd lay a mattress on that, and me and my three siblings would we could read, we could stretch out, they could torture me being the youngest, and we'd look for license plates. We went from New Jersey to Texas up to Michigan and up into New England, and we never saw a North Dakota license plate all the trips that we took. We didn't know whether North Dakota was so wonderful nobody ever wanted to leave, or whether they weren't allowed to leave. But anyway, it was except for when I was being tortured. And we'd play hearts and things. The first time I ever won a game of hearts without meaning to, my sisters and brother had ganged up on me, and they made me. I got all the hearts and the queen of spades. I was crying. I was really upset. My mother in the front seat turns around and said, "Don't you realize what just happened? You know, they all get the points. You don't get the points." And my sisters and brother had no idea that they had done that. So it was a lot of fun. But and we camped everywhere. We towed a trailer along with us, one of those tent trailers. So each of us kids got our own little pop tent when we were 10. It's like a rite of passage. So we all got our own tent. And I feel so sorry for kids today. I sound like an old poop here, but we didn't have to get strapped into the seats. We could just lounge, and it was so relaxing. And there was no, when are we going to get there? You know, we didn't mind if we went all, just we could drive for hours because we were having a great time back there.
Well, Jenny, thanks for calling. Do you feel sorry for your own kids, Rich?
You know, in a way, I mean, there's certainly trade-offs with everything. The highways of today and obviously the cars we drive are a lot safer. Far fewer people die on the highways today than back in the 1970s and 80s. But, man, it sure was nice being able to, you know, kind of explore the rear compartment of our car. Like I said, I would get up on the rear window shelf and enjoy my view from there. And I remember state highway patrolmen, you know, passing us by the side, and I'd be up there with maybe a candy cigarette sticking out of my mouth and just wave over to the cop, and he'd wave back. Or, you know, sometimes I would go down to the floorboard and get a nap in down there with the hump of the transmission housing, you know, gouging into my gut. You could never quite get comfortable down there. Or on those trips where we did have, like the previous caller, you know, a station wagon and just being able to sprawl out and kind of create my own little private fort in the back there. And I mean, those are experiences that our kids will never have, but I get it. You know, obviously, putting them in these car seats these days and making sure that they're safely buckled in back there does keep them much safer.
Jenny, thanks for your call. So we're going to go to another break, and we're going to play another song from your suggested list, Rich. And I have to confess, I'm not sure I know this song, Perfect Skin by Lloyd Cole and the Commotions.
Yeah, so he's one of my all-time, in fact, he is my all-time favorite musician. He came up with a band called, the Commotions. So it was Lloyd Cole and the Commotions. This was their first single. And this was a song that I associate with taking a drive down to Daytona Beach with my best friend for spring break in 1987. It just brings back some great memories of there. Just a few years ago, I got a chance to see Lloyd Cole play in Chicago. And my wife and I wind up at the bar after the show, and who sits down next to us but Lloyd Cole. I wind up having the chance to spend an hour and a half talking to, you know, this guy who's basically my musical god, my favorite musical artist of all time, and I'm a big music fan. And we just talked about every subject, from raising kids to his musical influences to everything. It was getting kind of late. It was like after midnight. He knew he was going to have a hard time getting a cab after the show. And he says, hey, did you guys drive? Would you mind giving me a lift back to my hotel? So I had my favorite musical artist of all time, Lloyd Cole, actually ride around in the back of my SUV as we took him back to his hotel room for the evening. It was that was an experience of a lifetime.
And they're all down in the cellar with their government grants. And my IQ, they brought me down to size. Academia Blues.
In New Hampshire, a meeting about how to attract a diverse workforce took a turn.
And as much as we are showing love, there's this showing hate. It's America's story, what's going on with us. It's the truth.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll learn more about tensions over diversity. And one city gets a new ball club, while another loses.
There's nothing left here. It's very sad because it was so different when I grew up here.
Please join us.
Coming up at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling, here on Maine Public Radio.
You know that little sticker on fruit, how when you pick it off, it like damages the fruit?
And then trying to flick it off your fingers, right? And you're like, why does it have to be so hard?
That is design. And design affects everything around us.
And if done right, everything around us could be transformed to bring a better experience.
Ideas about the power of design, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock, then again Wednesday night at 11 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program. Memories of being crammed in the backseat of a car headed somewhere for a family vacation. Joining us today, Rich Ratay. He is the author of Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Rich, Crowded House is not from the 1970s. Why is this one of your favorite road trip songs?
Just another one of those songs that stirs up some incredible memories for me. This wasn't a road trip around America. This was a road trip around Australia. My wife and I had the opportunity to go to Australia in, I think, 2000. And we rented a car and we went on a little road trip down Great Ocean Road, which traces the southern coast of Australia, passes some great seaside towns and the 12 apostles, a fantastic set of rock formations. There's 12 of them, or there at least used to be until a couple crumbled, I understand, a few years ago. But this song came on the radio. Crowded House isn't actually an Australian band. They're from New Zealand, but I think Australia kind of adopted them as their own. And it just stirs up the wonderful memories of that unforgettable journey along Great Ocean Road for me.
We have an email from Priscilla. She writes, "Who remembers when the old post road was the only way to get from southern Connecticut to Maine? I was 6 the first time we made that trip to vacation in the Belgrade Lakes. Memories include windows down, no air conditioning, whizzing by tobacco fields and factories, endless stretches of green dotted with cows with my sister and I counted. She on the left side, me on the right." So wonderful story. She says, "Mom only trusted Howard Johnson's and we'd be really hungry by the time we reached one." So thanks so much, Priscilla, for sharing that memory. We will go to Mary calling from Bangor. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. So we used to go on a lot of different road trips when we were younger, but one of my most exciting one was when we drove on Route 66 as kids. My dad drove us in a chunk of it from like Las Vegas area into Arizona. And basically there are a bunch of mountains through there. And there are a lot of, like, the Route 66 kind of goes along cliff sides. And we had rented a Mustang convertible, and my sister had her learner's permit. And they let her drive on the hairpin turns on the cliff sides on Route 66. And it was just such an amazing experience that when my sister and I got older, we did the same thing. We actually drove all of Route 66 together. We rented a Mustang convertible, and it was just amazing. But what's funny about Route 66 now is you can't use GPS because it keeps trying to get you to go onto I-40. So it was like 3 years ago, we had to use a printout from like a black and white website. It wasn't even a really well-made website, but it was turn-by-turn in directions on how to stay on Route 66.
That's hilarious. That almost reminds me of those old AAA triptychs that we'd have to use in order to navigate, along our road trips. So it's kind of fun that you went on an old school style road trip and then had to use old school navigation in order to find your way. That's fantastic.
Mary, thanks for your call. We'll move to Harold from Hollowell. Hi, Harold. Go ahead.
Hello. I think that no road trips story should be complete without the list of equipment failures that one encounters along the way. The specific trip I'm talking about is a trip that my family of four took in 1964, traveling in a 1958 Plymouth station wagon. It started out with a bubble on a tire on the New York Thruway. We were going from Massachusetts to Montana and back. Then we hit Buffalo and broke a spring. This is a front spring that's torsion bar. Then we didn't have much trouble until we got to North Dakota, another flat tire. But the culmination was in Montana. We had some work done, including replacing parts of the exhaust system and a tune-up. They neglected to tighten things up there. And the exhaust system fell off, but the creme de la creme was when, traveling at 60 miles an hour, a spark plug blew out.
Oh.
Wow.
You've had some mishaps too, haven't you, Rich?
Yeah, you know, and the caller brings up a great point, though. I mean, that's one of the things I think we tend to forget about these days, and that our children will never, experience for themselves. But you know, those old road trips that we took in the 1960s and 70s, those road trips at that time, I mean, you felt a lot more like you were setting off by yourselves on an expedition into the wild frontier, because if anything went wrong with your car, it was kind of up to you to do something about it. Either you had to know how to fix your car, have somebody in the car who could fix it, or you were going to have to hitchhike. I mean, help wasn't just a cell phone call away. There weren't nearly as many exits with service stations and access to help that we have today. You were really on your own as a family to deal with a mechanical breakdown back at that time. And it was a big deal because our cars weren't nearly as reliable back then as they are today.
Harold, thanks for calling. We've got Edie in Blue Hill. Hi, Edie. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I live in Maine now, but I grew up living in Atlanta. My father was from upstate New York, and my mother was from Atlanta. And every summer, we would drive to Little Deer Isle, Maine. And I'm 70, so this was going back quite a while. And whenever we got to the bridge that goes from the mainland to Little Deer Isle, I was always so excited. And that bridge wasn't built too long before I was born, or maybe a little after I was born. But anyway, the bridge is what I remember, not the ferry. And then when we'd get to our driveway, a dirt driveway, we'd almost always see a deer run across the road as we drove up to our house. And I just loved that every summer. And my father, he graduated from Princeton in 1923, and he and a friend drove across the country. And I don't have many details, but it must have been an adventure.
It must have been.
When I was about 10, we drove across the Mojave Desert. And one of the things I remember is that to cool the car, there was a canvas water bag. Maybe these are still used. I don't know. But to help keep the engine cool.
I've never heard of that. Have you, Rich? Somebody hanging a canvas water bag over the engine to keep it cool.
Wow. I can understand the usage there. But no, I've never heard of that before.
Edie, thank you so much for calling in and sharing. An email from Jean. She writes, an annual road trip in the back of a Ford Country Squire. Me and my 5 siblings, Lordy. 3 youngest on a blanket in the way back, all the way to my Uncle Bill's small cabin with no indoor plumbing. When we arrived to the edge of the dirt road, we all had to get out of the car and walk to the cabin so the car would not bottom out. I remember discovering the stars one night while going to the outhouse. My father once told us we were going to a neighbor's house to have eel for dinner. Memorable moments in Maine. We're going to try to squeeze in one more call. We'll go to Mark calling from Portland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much for hosting this program. It's amazing. I was born in 1950 in Atlanta, and at age 6, I went to live with a foster family, and it was from them that I contracted a lifelong case of wanderlust. One year, we took a road trip in the back of a green monster country squire station wagon, 3, my 2 brothers and I in the back seat, Dee and Jack in the front, Jack always driving. He would sing songs and keep us entertained. We would play games and fight each other. The cooler was in the back, the very back with the suitcases. And we went across the southern tier of states from Atlanta to Disneyland in L.A. before it was anything like it is now. And we stopped in, New Orleans and Arkansas and the Boulder Dam in, Arizona? And then we came back across the northern tier, and we collected elk antlers in Montana, came down through Washington, went to the Smithsonian. An amazing trip. The next year, we took a road trip from Atlanta up to Quebec to visit their friends who lived somewhere they had access to a glacier lake. And we came back down, and the next year we took a road trip from Atlanta down to the end of Key West
Wow, Mark, we're at the end of the show, so I have to say thank you, but thank you for calling in. And very quickly, Richard Tay, before I let you go, the name of your book is Don't Make Me Pull Over. You're a dad now. Do you ever say that to your kids?
Oh, all the time. Are you kidding? My guys are 14 and 12 years old now, and they're always up to something no good in the backseat.
And do you ever actually pull over?
No, just like my dad, I'm kind of about making time. Now, I'm much more apt to stop off at some of those fun roadside attractions. I've learned to appreciate those. But yeah, I'm not going to waste time pulling over to get them to get on their better behavior.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. That's Richard Rattay. He has worked as an award-winning advertising copywriter for 25 years. He is the author of the new book, Don't Make Me Pull Over, An Informal History of the Family Road Trip. Sandra Harris ran the board today. Our volunteer, Jane Vaughn, answered your calls. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandreau. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.